Diane Ackerman and her husband Paul West, both writers, had built their relationship and 40-year marriage on the intricacies of words and wordplay. But when, at 74, Paul suffered a stroke that rendered him largely unable to communicate, it was not only his joy of communication that was devastated, but also the foundations of their marriage. 100 Names for Love, Ms. Ackerman's new memoir published by Norton, chronicles the couple's struggle to rehabilitate Paul and rebuild their relationship, and I'm very pleased that it brings Diane Ackerman back to our show today. It's always a pleasure to see you.
Thank you. Lovely to be with you again.
You've been here in the past in two capacities, as a poet and as a naturalist. Haven't you studied and written about the brain?
Yes, indeed. I was on a book tour for An Alchemy of Mine, a book about how the brain becomes the mind, when Paul had this stroke take place. So in a sense, I was the worst possible person to have a spouse with a stroke, but also the best.
Well, you must have, in thinking about that, have been prepared on some level to deal with this. Or is it possible to even be prepared for such an event?
I'm not sure it's ever possible to be prepared for a complete change of life or change of marriage. But if you think about it, any couple that stays together long, probably it isn't one marriage, but several. Things happen to them and they have to embrace it. In my case, I knew in chilling detail what had happened, but I also knew the latest findings in neuroscience, that the brain is very plastic. It's not what we were always told, that there can be no changes made, but that some neurons can take over for others.
But at the start, I'm assuming your background as a poet, where finding just the right word is a major goal, made it a bit frustrating to watch what Paul was going through.
It was. On the other hand, I was able to apply as much of my poet's background to understanding the absolute hilarity of what aphasics tend to say, and just open my mind a little bit more to his new circumstances.
So he was aphasic, but there are different kinds of aphasia.
He had the worst kind because...
It's called global aphasia?
Global. He could not understand anything anyone said to him. He couldn't read or write. Suddenly he couldn't do math. This for a man who had published almost 50 books, taught for 30 years, had a first at Oxford, you know, used to lecture in the RAF on giving good lectures. Our lives were completely enthralled by words. So it was a big change, but I decided that I would see how much improvement I could get back for him.
I remember when a friend had a stroke and serious aphasia, she thought she was saying, sit down and I'll go get you a cup of coffee, but she was saying something that just sounded like gobbledygook.
Yes, that
her tongue was not moving to where her brain was telling it to go.
That's true. And it's not that the person doesn't have an intellectual life. Years later, when Paul regained quite a lot of speech, he could tell me what was going on in his mind. And it was absolutely fascinating. He had three voices all of a sudden speaking to him, including the voice of a BBC announcer.
So he just, this is something that developed after the stroke? Or had it always been there, do you think?
No, I think it developed after the stroke because the brain was shaken up in really interesting ways.
Well, there are different kinds of aphasia. There's Wernicke's aphasia. There's Broca's aphasia. What did
yes.
he have?
He had both. So he had trouble speaking, but he also had trouble understanding. And the great challenge, really, was to somehow be a caregiver on my part and find ways to help him relearn language. And he just worked like the Dickens.
Well, I would assume that there's also the frustration of not being able to communicate made him both depressed and angry at times.
It did, and that's perfectly normal. And I insisted that he be put on an antidepressant right away and also on Ritalin to help with focus. And then I decided to just saturate him in language. And I hired the most wonderful, cutest nursing student who would swim with him for a couple of hours every day, a real chatterbox. Oh, yes, and wear her bikini because I thought that would inspire him to pay attention. And she saturated him in language.
That's physical therapy on a number of levels.
Hey, there you go. And I made up different kinds of workbook exercises for him.
What had happened to his memory?
He remembered long-term, but he didn't remember short-term. And something very odd happened that I had never read about before, but I began to realize it as I was watching him. And that was that, yes, he lost all of the simple words, like table and chair and mother and so on, that we learn when we're little. But he retained all of the big words that you learned as a grown-up or maybe through your specialty or a hobby. So he would come to me and say, "Where's my jerkin?" And I'd say, "Oh, your jacket. It's on the table." Or he would start talking about postillions or tardigrades. Or he would confuse his speech therapist because he would mention a tesseract. And they would say, "That's a nonsense word." And then I would say, "No, actually, a tesseract, three-dimensional object unfolded into the fourth dimension. He's pointing at the telephone. In a weird way, that's what it is." And so working with him.
So telephone had become tesseract?
It did for him. Hmm. And one morning he got up. All he wanted to ask for was his velour jogging suit. But instead he asked for his cantilever of light. And, you know, we had been married so long that I instinctively knew that's what he meant.
Had he forgotten things from the childhood? You say he had long-term. What about?
No, it was the short-term.
But what about your relationship? Did he seem to remember everything that had gone on, as he might have under other circumstances?
There was one really important thing that he didn't remember. We had always been very kissy, sentimental sweethearts. And he forgot every pet name for me. And so as part of his therapy, I suggested he might want to make up some new ones. And as we were saying, with aphasia, all the wrong words get blurted out. And this was a way for him to kind of dominate it. So one pet name a day, he started making them up for 100 days in a row. And that's where the title of the book comes from. And they were so wild. Some of my favorites were my snowy Tanganyika, spy elf of the morning hallelujahs. You can see looking at me why I liked my little bucket of hair and so on.
Well, so the poetic side was actually coming out.
Well, it was coming out inadvertently. You know, this was something I as a poet would have to really work hard for to put together, "O Parakeet of the Lissom Star," which was one of his names.
He called you "O Parakeet of the Lissom Star"?
Don't you love that? Or he called me "My Billiard Table of the Decaying Gods." It was so much fun. And when there is something catastrophic in a family like stroke, and it touches so many households, millions in America, I think that play and laughter is one of the first things to go.
My guest is Diane Ackerman, whose latest book is 100 Names for Love, A Stroke, A Marriage, and the Language of Healing. It's published by Norton. Well, at the beginning, he was in the hospital. And a hospital, when you're in the hospital, you're just lying there.
There
isn't a lot to remember, is there?
No. You know, you were asking me about my background as a poet and a naturalist, and I don't know if there can be a natural history of illness, but partly the book is that, because my favorite way to transcend is to commune with nature and to pretend for a moment that I'm Margaret Mead appearing suddenly somewhere and observing the customs and the rituals for the first time. And that's what I did in the hospital too. And I was quite shocked at how the things that go on in a hospital play havoc with your senses in a very subtle way. For example, the lights overhead are only ever on as if the sun is at noon. That's not normal. It's misinforming your brain. And there is so much pinging and worrying. And there are people who wake you in the night and they are uncommonly interested in body fluids. You know, it's kind of like an alien abduction situation.
So that can be confusing even if you haven't had a stroke.
Exactly.
Did you worry that prolonged hospitalization would somehow hold him back?
I did. And not just that, but I think it affects visitors in profound ways, too. And we really need to think about what the culture of being in a hospital is like and how we can improve it for people. You know, we're talking about stroke, and most people think of stroke just happening with people who are elderly, but I'd like to remind people that there are 300,000 cases of traumatic brain injury a year for young people in traffic accidents, gunshot wounds, and the Pentagon says that 200,000 young soldiers have returned home with injuries like this, and a lot of them have very similar language problems, too.
They have to go through aphasia and then therapy?
And unfortunately, insurance doesn't cover very much rehabilitation.
So therapy, of course, is part of the hospitalization experience.
But never enough.
But did he respond positively to it at first?
He did at first, just a little bit. But unfortunately, it's designed for people in very acute situations. And even today, a lot of therapy is based on lesson plan, as with most teaching, rather than on trying to figure out how the individual learns best. So at a certain point, I just discovered that it wasn't doing enough for him. We went through 5 speech therapists, and they were noble-hearted people. But you really have to deal with each person as an individual. And it was at that point that I just found it too heartbreaking and decided to try to figure out what would help him.
So one of the things was to bring him home.
One of the things was to bring him home.
Did he want to do that?
He was desperate to get home. In fact, home was one of the very few words that he could say. When this first happened, all he could say was one syllable, mem. And that's not unusual. The poet Baudelaire was only left saying, goddamn, which was unfortunate because he was being taken care of by nuns. So they thought that he was just blaspheming all day long. And lots of other famous artists, you know, ended up in the same situation. But because of the nature of the illness, they couldn't describe what was happening to them.
Of course, your house was not the same after he returned because I'm assuming that both of you wrote during the day in separate rooms?
Yes, we did tend to write in separate rooms, normally across the hall from each other.
Did you go back and forth during that time, or would you want to be as secluded as possible and Paul be as secluded as
possible? Before the stroke?
Yeah.
Before the stroke, we were as secluded as possible, but we were only a couple of feet apart. And he would type on an old-fashioned typewriter. So I would hear that nasty little bell ringing at the end of the line, which, you know, was always reminding me that he was being much more creative than I was, working on a couple of feet of poetry. But we could visit with each other and we could share inspirations and so on. After the stroke, life changed dramatically. And it was not just a question of how to help him in a medical sense. You know, it was a larger question of how do you handle a changed relationship with grace and ingenuity and patience and love?
Well, he couldn't type because he'd lost the use of one of his hands, hadn't he?
That's true. And over the years, he did learn how to write one-handed. We're told all the time, and we're told in books and also by a lot of doctors, unfortunately, that there is a window of opportunity after some sort of brain damage of any kind. And that just isn't true. You can make improvements 1 year, 5 years, 10 years later, and they can be incredibly meaningful.
In the hospital, usually we are in quiet environments. But here's a man who needs to get as many words into his brain as possible. How did you do that?
In the hospital, I just kept talking with him all the time, but that was not a good situation to do it in. There were too many distractions.
Do you think that he was understanding what you were saying every time?
I think that, in fact, I know that he was not understanding, but that he thought he was making sense and that for some very perverse reason, people were pretending not to understand him. At home, it was still very difficult for him to understand. But more heartbreaking for me by far was that he at first had lost his ability to make images. He had lost his vivid way of describing the world, and he had been such a stylist stylistic writer and thinker.
You mean he'd lost metaphor?
He had lost metaphor. And so since we couldn't communicate with words at first, I would get in bed with him every morning and we would cuddle for about, an hour or so and giggle. And, you know, it's like with stuttering and the King's Speech. The more stress you're under, the harder it is to speak when you have aphasia. But if you're just waking up and you're feeling cozy, it's a little bit easier. And I would tease him, and I started calling him Wombat, for example, and said, okay, Mr. Wombat, Mrs. Wombat, what do you think their first names are? You know, do you think they have children? How many? What do you think the kids' names are? And we would play word games like this, and he would make up pet names and so on. And with one thing and another, the brain, his brain, with the gift of plasticity that it has, the gift of mending itself, finally began to hit its groove again.
Would watching television and listening to radio have helped?
It did help, and he had favorites that he watched on television. He loved to watch Judge Judy at first because she spoke very distinctively and emphatically. And then he loved watching Brian Williams and Rachel Maddow. Again, the way they phrased things, the rhythm, and they seemed very compassionate.
There are some harrowing passages in the book in which Paul recounts his sense of self during the first very difficult months after his stroke. Can you talk about what he says he experienced and how – and you say he was having problems dealing with the fact that he was unable to communicate. I'm assuming he was also very frustrated by that.
He was deeply frustrated and very depressed and suicidal, all of which is quite normal after really any kind of brain illness. And at some point I thought, what can I do for him that will solve a lot of problems that are going on? And I suggested he might want to try writing the first aphasic novel or memoir. He could barely speak, but he thought it was a good idea. And so I had him dictating. It was unbelievably laborious, but it was very therapeutic for him.
You know, was that the Shadow Factory?
It was.
Been published by Powell Books?
Yes, and it was Lumen Books. It was very therapeutic for him because I've since learned, when people have any kind of chronic illness, it really helps them to tell their story to someone, not just to communicate and interact with someone, but as a way to organize their version of what happened to themselves and as a way to re-inhabit their life again.
Now, what happens to you? You're a writer and a naturalist, and now suddenly you're a full-time caregiver.
Almost nobody knew when I published The Zookeeper's Wife. I think I was visiting you to talk about that
book. You didn't tell me that your husband had a stroke.
No, nobody
knew.
And
Paul had been on the show earlier.
That's right. And no one knew that I was writing that book after his stroke while I was still a full-time caregiver. And it really was my sanctuary. A caregiver is greatly changed by the culture of illness.
How far has he come along since?
He's now able to be quite fluent for about 3 hours a day. He still sundowns the way a lot of people do. We say that we're crashing, you know, towards that part of the day. He sundowns. But during that period of 3 hours, he can communicate quite well. He's written a couple of books since then. He's working on a memoir. He's come a great distance. And if anything, he's happier than I've ever known him to be. He's living very much in the moment. And we just consider each day a spectacular gift.
In just a few moments we have left, what would you like to see change about the way stroke patients are treated?
The first thing is that people should understand that because somebody can't speak doesn't mean that they don't have a mind. Very often, their intellect is quite intact. In fact, most often. Also, people are afraid to communicate with them, but there are so many wonderful ways to do it. There have been a lot of famous people who had strokes, like Samuel Beckett, for instance, and who retained an extraordinary sense of creativity and self. And it's just a question of finding new and creative ways to be loving friends and caregivers.
Diane Ackerman is the best-selling author of A Natural History of the Senses, more recently The Zookeeper's Wife. There have been a number of other books. And her latest is called 100 Names for Love, A Stroke, A Marriage, and the Language of Healing. It is published by Norton. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Yeah.